This is the Warren Weeks Show podcast.
And you're establishing that competence and confidence that allows you to go in to the CEO's office and go toe-to-toe. And if they say, I don't think so, you need to have the confidence to say, yeah, we need to do this. And here's why. Here's how it affects the business. Here's what happens when we don't. Here's what happens if we do. And sometimes that has to be said in about 8 seconds, because that's all the bandwidth they're going to give you. And I have been in those situations where I've had probably 4 seconds to reverse position on something. So and you got to be thick-skinned. So, you know, I still go to these AIBC CPRS conferences, and this is always on the agenda. Why my CEO won't listen to me?
My guest today is a veteran corporate communications pro, and more recently, a professor and program coordinator with the PR and communications program at Centennial College. FYI, this chat was recorded in late August, about 9 days into the Lisa LaFlamme Bell Media story, just to put that part of the conversation in the right context. We covered a ton of ground in an hour. We talked about crisis communications, dealing with CEOs, the glass ceiling in the PR industry, and much, much more. This is my conversation with Donna Lindell. I'd like to start out with the story that's been beaten to death a little bit, which is the Lisa LaFlamme story. So obviously everyone in Canada knows the story. Now, I think most people around the world have heard it. What are your thoughts on the story? Where, not to say what was going on behind the scenes, but when you see something like this take place and the reaction that has taken place, what are your thoughts? What are some of the things that go through your mind?
Well, I'm thrilled at the reaction, for one, and perhaps Lisa calculated that reaction in her exit strategy. So good for her, because she's really can just sit back and let the world make her case for her, which is exactly what's happening. You know, I saw a couple of posts, people wanting to throw the corp comms department under the bus. My take is that they were not consulted prior to this happening. And then they were scrambling to, put the toothpaste back in the tube or, you know, fix it, as often happens. And even then the executives weren't listening because, and especially in a broadcast situation, whatever you do internally is essentially a media release. You know, and we saw that with CBC years ago and the Gian Gomeshi, you know, internal comms, they actually released their internal comms. So the notion that this town hall was leaked is ridiculous. They should have just sent it out anyways. But I suspect the comms department is not being listened to. I also, if this is a case of, misogyny, there's a good chunk of the comms departments. I haven't looked to see who's running it, but often they're led by women and often many women in the organization. And they perhaps just are being tuned out, which is too bad, because this is going to sit with them for a very, very long time. I'm not sure how they recover their image, especially, you know, an organization that likes to do the let's talk and let's fix mental health. I think it's done some real damage. Unfortunately, I think as Canadians, we're beholden to giant telco companies. You know, we saw what happened with Rogers in the summer as well, with the no service and most of Canada, and people couldn't, you know, use their ATMs or, you know, make purchases. So I don't know what's going to happen, and, you know, if the government should step in or with the monopolies, but I mean, that's a whole other situation. But I love what Dove Canada did. And they stepped in yesterday and they just said, we're all over this, and are turning this into a PR opportunity and have donated money. And I mean, it's so on brand for them. And, you know, should they be taking advantage of another organization's misery? Yeah, go for it. Right. I think the future is really organizations taking matters of social justice into their own hands, not waiting for governments or other, you know, just do it. Because those who are offended, you probably don't want them as your customers anyways. Chances are you're going to win customers in the end. And it's a great opportunity to, you know, promote your brand.
The leadership of Bell has to be, or Bell Media has to be thinking like, I can't believe this is still, and it just seems to be getting worse. If not worse, it's certainly smoldering 9 days later. Do you think that they thought this was going to be like a quick, you know, in and out one day news story? We get rid of her, we swap him in.
I even don't know. I would also speculate that the CEO didn't even know this was going to happen. This to me feels like a decision that a couple people did, thought, oh, it's a business decision. This is within my purview. I'm just going to do it. And this story, like, talk about a story with legs. You know, this is like a centipede of stories. It's not going to, like, and then, you know, they've got this review, which most people agree is you know, lip service. And, you know, hoping it'll go away. There, we said we'd do a review. Now stop bugging us. Well, it's no, you know, because to change culture within an organization takes more than a review. I mean, we see this with Hockey Canada right now, right? It's turning around a giant ship, and they're not being forthcoming or transparent at all in their decisions. And kudos to the employees who went on the attack in that town hall and just held their feet to the fire. And I find the reasoning, you know, well, I'm a female. Well, that can't, you know, so that can't be the reason we do it. Heard of Queen Bee syndrome? Yes, it can be the reason. Absolutely. That's not.
Man. What do you think happens next for, and I, you know, I hesitate to ask prediction questions, but what do you think happens next for Lisa LaFlamme? Does she ride off into the sunset? Does she join another, because there are not a lot of places to go in the media in Canada. Does she do her own thing somehow?
No, but I think like a lot of women, and there's, you know, quite a few that have fallen over the past, I would say just even a couple of years, that are starting, you know, their own thing. They're starting to do, like, because you don't necessarily have to be beholden to the square box that broadcasting fits in now. There's ample opportunities to create your own platforms and channels and podcasts and whatnot. So she'll resurrect herself for sure. Her image isn't the least bit damaged by this. In fact, it's been emboldened, if anything. So she'll find some way to, you know, kind of show them. And good for her, right? But yeah, she hasn't gone away whatsoever, and nor do I want her to go away, and Canadians don't want her to go away, right? She's got a lot to give.
Anyone I speak to says great hard worker, objective, just nose to the grindstone for like 35 years with one organization. It's unheard right? of. And then just to have this kind of like send off, just kind of gross.
Well, then you also saw the Danielle Graham layered on top of that, right? And like that, just like, you just go, wow, this is a pattern of really bad behavior of mistreating people. And you can't do that anymore. It's, you know, those days are over. I loved Romeo Dallaire's Twitter post that he put. Just like, what? I need more of those, because that's exactly, like, I love that level of anger. Just say, like, it's 2022. Are we still here? Like, is that what's going on?
Now, one of the comments that you made, and this is a common theme that shows up, like, I've had a number of corporate communications folks and journalism people here on the podcast, and the distinction between the PR folks and the leadership. Every organization's a little bit different. I know that, you know, for example, you worked at Manulife for like, what, six years and a bit?
Yeah.
I've done work with them as well. It seems to be, to me, I don't know if you'd agree, an organization that takes communications seriously and would take communications counsel seriously. Other organizations where communications is not even at the table. And I don't know, this is just conjecture, but, you know, we look at the Rogers situation and the Bell Media situation recently, and I've resigned myself to the fact that I'm never going to work with either one of those organizations based on the stuff I've put out on LinkedIn the last couple of months. But you just know in your being that there are people in the corporate communications department just pulling out their hair, just like how they know what should be done, but like either they're not being asked or they're being ignored.
So there's a few things. So I'm going to say, you know, it depends. So it depends on the CEO. If they get it, if they get the value of communications and they get that area of the company is sort of equitable to the legal department in terms of the advice that it should be counseling the, you know, the trusted advisor, then that relationship will be strong. But many, many CEOs don't get that. And they regard communications as a necessary evil. It's the department that writes well. Like, what do you need us to do? Write well. Right. They, you know, or they, I call it sort of the waitressing model of communications. Right. We need a news release. Can you get it to us in 2 hours? What is it about? Okay. And then you write it and then you get it and it goes out. Right. So there is actually news, sort of probably more organizations than we would ever imagine probably are operating without a communications strategic plan that aligns to the you know, the organizational business plan. So part of that is, you know, CEO understanding of the role, CEO desire to listen to advice. But part of it is also on the other side, the communications department, strategic capabilities. Do they understand the business? Shockingly, many don't, right? They're quite happy to live in that tactical pond and not stretch out to be strategic. And in order to be strategic, you need to understand the business and how it operates, you know, what's keeping the CEO up at night. And then all of those external factors that exist outside, you know, the bubble of the organization that could impact the company. And all of those layers allow you to become a strategic advisor, which all, you know, comes with training. You know, this is how I train our students to be strategic thinkers, not tacticians. That is the future of PR. But also it takes years of experience to feel confident giving that advice. And it's also establishing credibility. And a good chunk of a communicator's time is spent establishing credibility so the CEO and the executives understand the value that you can bring an organization. And that is, you know, bragging about your results, showing, you know, measurement and evaluation of what you're doing and how it impacts. And we didn't, you know, speak on this and our stock price tanked. And then we issued a statement and our stock price went back up. Like, all of that has to be connected. And so it's a lot of work on the side of the communicator to build those relationships with your internal clients so that they understand the value that they can bring. But on the role of the communicator, it means that you're constantly training, you're constantly scanning what's going on, you're constantly networking, and you're establishing that competence and confidence that allows you to go in to the CEO's office and go toe-to-toe. And if they say, I don't think so, you need to have the confidence to say, yeah, we need to do this. And here's why. Here's how it affects the business. Here's what happens when we don't. Here's what happens if we do. And sometimes that has to be said in about 8 seconds because that's all the bandwidth they're going to give you. And I have been in those situations where I've had probably 4 seconds to reverse position on something. So and you got to be thick-skinned. So, you know, I still go to these AIBC CPRS conferences, and this is always on the agenda. Why my CEO won't listen to me? You know, you're developing a relationship, but you really do have to understand the business from the communications point of view. It's not, you can't blame the CEO and you can't blame the communicator. It really is sort of this ongoing process to build that trust between the two parties.
I found in the past, and I've been in similar situations as well, with CEOs of associations and organizations, trying to convince them of something. And I'm trying to think, like, because a lot of times you're just, it's a frustrating process and you can see their eyes kind of glazing over. I found one thing that was helpful was examples. Here's a company that did this and it worked, Maple Leaf Foods or whatever. Here's a company that didn't do it, XL Foods, and then they got all sold off. Or trying to almost play to their, it's another bit of a tactic, but to play to their ego a little bit. Like, this is not only 100%. The best, this is not the best thing for the company, it's also the best thing for you. So have you seen
make
things
it
like-
make feel like it's their idea and then you're- Right. Absolutely. Like, if you can say the competition's already doing this, and yes, providing, so that's, you know, just looking at my curriculum, for next semester, right? Like, we teach research. You have to go in well researched to prove your case to the executive. And those are case studies. That's, you know, statistics, you know, whatever, here's proof that this works. And it feels like, you know, instinctually this is going to work, but they need convincing, because a lot of them don't understand what communications is and can offer. Again, they, you know, they think it's as simple as writing a few paragraphs. You know, we saw that, for example, you know, we now bring in the curriculum, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we know that after, you know, that summer with, Black Lives Matter, you know, just imagine the CEO calling down to the comms department and say, yeah, write me up a tweet. And right. Well, that's not the way it's done, nor should it be done. And so the communicator now more than ever really has to interject themselves. You know, it's that proverbial seat at the table. Rather than ask for permission, just pull up a chair, I think I read somewhere, and be part of that development so that it's a strategic alignment and that you're doing it with a strategic sensibility. And it's not just because that kind of like send me out a tweet. If it's not lived and breathed within an organization, it's just going to backfire anyways.
It's like ticking a box PR. So you've been,
I think a lot of organizations are kind of a lot of more people now, I think, because of social media are onto the, that, you know, this has been PR'd.
Yeah. You can kind of feel it. There's a disingenuous quality to it.
And
it
kind of backfires. Absolutely. Yeah.
You've been with Centennial College, I guess close to 11 years. I was looking on LinkedIn. I think that's about right. A little over a decade.
Yeah. It's 11, lost count.
11
yeah.
years and change. would you, when you think of yourself as a professional, do you think of yourself as an educator first or a communicator first, or how do you view that?
I think I still regard myself as a communicator first, and, you know, and training the next level of employees for organizations. So I'm kind of, to me, I feel like a little bit of an extension of their HR department of organizations, where I'm able to sort of send them new recruits that are, you know, trained and ready to go and hit the ground running. So I still feel that aspect, I think, which is odd, but that's kind of how I regard it. And kind of train them as such so that they're leaving job ready. Right. And so, you know, sometimes that means a little bit of tough love and telling them what's real. And all of our faculty have experience. So we've all got the bumps and bruises to show for and to share. And I think that that's a huge benefit for the students, even though, you know, things have evolved somewhat. They haven't evolved that much if Lisa LaFlamme situations are still happening.
The younger generations often get a knock against them. They're soft, the snowflake generation, whether it's millennials, Gen Z, that kind of thing. You're dealing with these, I don't want to call them kids. You're dealing with these young folks on a day-to-day basis. Do you think that that is fair, or what are you seeing when you're looking at these future communicators that you're dealing with?
Be careful here.
Don't want to get you in trouble.
I see, you know, and it's hard to make blanket statements, but people generally, when they're coming into a post-grad, they are ready to work. They're ready to, like, I know what I want now. I've done the research. I've done my 4 years. It's not landing me a job. You know, I want something that will, you know, get me a job at the end of, you know, my 8 month investment. And so they will work hard. I think, you know, and we build in a lot of the soft skills that are required, like collaboration, conflict management, flexibility, adaptability. I mean, we saw such amazing resilience during COVID and being online. It was really remarkable. They were like, we'll do whatever it takes. We're online. They all showed up. They all participated. They all engaged. This is the first in 2 weeks, I'll be going back to the classroom for the first time since March 13th, 2020.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's a whole new, it's not a whole new game, but it's a new adjustment. We're doing a little bit of half and half. So they're going to only have 2 hours rather than 4 hours of in class, classroom time. They have 2 hours and then the other two will be asynchronous.
I haven't been a student in many years. When it comes, and I don't think PR programs were even around when I was in school. We had journalism programs, but I can't remember communications per se. We had a class on it, but I don't think there were schools. If they had that, I'd definitely be going into it today. What are the skills that you think are most important to these? You talk about, you know, everyone writing press releases and writing, making things pretty, but what are the most valuable hard skills you think these young folks are learning these days from your program?
I think I really try to enforce that strategic sensibility, because I think in that relationship building, that's where the future of PR is. I mean, AI will take over writing one day, and it is doing some news releases, you know, or to an extent. And so they really need to strengthen their capabilities to be advisors and to feel comfortable with that. And again, collaboration and adaptability. Again, we're focusing on how they can add value to an organization. So with respect to diversity, equity, and inclusion, what is the role of the communicator when organizations are trying to kind of wrap their arms around it and make changes, organizational change. So it's really being able to adapt to the future, but still at the core of communications, whether you're an agency or in corporate, is that relationship aspect. And understanding, we have now data management as part of the curriculum, because you need to not only be able to read it and understand it and assess it at the back end of a campaign, but at the beginning to inform it. I really try to enforce that holistic thinking. And again, going back to like, how does this piece that I just read connect to this? And how combined will it add value to an organization? I think the other aspect is solid researching. I did my master's in PR a few years ago, and that was all remote through Mount St. Vincent. Mm. And what I noticed from when I was practicing and then as an academic is that very few practitioners tap into the body of academic research that exists about PR. And I think that's a real missed opportunity. There is so much out there that is free and accessible, that has been written by, you know, academics in the field, that I think can lend, or that I know can support that credibility piece and research and case studies and, you know, all of that. I teach crisis comms from a theoretical perspective. For that reason, so that they understand that theoretical, because all a theory is a way to describe best practices. That's all. So I think when they understand how to sort of organize thinking around many, many different types of crises, it can help them make their case when they go into an executive saying, here, we need to do this.
The research thing you mentioned is really interesting because, and this is not formal by any stretch of the imagination, but I was helping an organization that was dealing a couple of weeks ago with a small C crisis, and they were just running some stuff by me to see, how does this messaging sound? How does this positioning sound? Have we thought of this? Have we thought of that? All the different audiences. And it's sometimes nice to get an external person's viewpoint who's kind of been, you know, it's not their first rodeo kind of thing. And one of the things that I encouraged them to do is I said, and I haven't done this myself for this issue, but go on Google, look up the terms of your crisis, and I guarantee you it's happened in other places. And you can actually look at the media coverage. It's like a time machine, and you can see which ones did it well, which ones didn't do it well. Take some of the stuff from the ones that do it well, and you can actually help avoid some mistakes. And I would extend that to almost to any company that's dealing with a crisis. Someone has dealt with a version of it before. And Google can be your best friend in that situation.
Yep. And that, you know, even understanding, you know, there's situational crisis communications theory is really that there's different situations that require different responses depending on who's at fault. Because the first thing you try to figure out who's at fault. And when you understand oh, there's not just one reaction at our disposal. There's like eight and combinations. And so I think that opens the possibilities for students. You know, we cover now in crisis comms, natural disasters. You know, that was added on in the era of climate change. What is the role of the communicator? You know, that used to be sort of preserved for, oh, if you work in emergency services, you might need this. But now every single organization, doesn't matter who you are, needs to be have, you know, a climate change communications understanding so that when something happens, you're prepared. And so we cover that as well. So all of these things have been added every year to make sure that we're really giving the most up-to-date information for students.
What's your origin story when it comes to communications? How did you get into it? How did you hear about it? Why did you, because I find everyone does it for a different reason. What's yours?
I went into journalism at Carleton. Did that for 4 years. Why? I think, you know, I enjoyed storytelling, geography and history, right? Which I think is why a lot of people and just an innate curiosity. I never really did journalism, but I ended up in third year journalism. There was a summer job posting on the board for the Canadian Chamber of Commerce to write articles for their membership magazine. So I got that job, although none of my stories were published. So by the end of the summer, beginning of my fourth year, I went into my boss had been let go. So I went into his boss and I said, let me put the magazine until you find someone else. And he said, well, if you can put it together, why do I need to find someone else? So I was manager publications in fourth year journalism school with this job. So, you know, after a class, I'd hop on a plane and go to a meeting in Toronto and sort of balance the two. So I did that and ended up in media relations. So I think PR was always where I kind of knew that that's where I wanted to be. But it, to your point, it was never offered, not in an overt way, you know. So I think, yeah, now there's more schools. Like Centennial has a Bachelor of Public Relations program now. That is, it's kind of best kept secret. So I teach in that program as well.
Do you have a favorite illustration of public relations in a movie or a TV series? Some people talk about like CJ from the West Wing or something.
Yes.
What stands out for you? Which characters?
Okay, I'm going to take her. Yeah. I watched that show. She was awesome. When Jen Psaki was press secretary for Biden, she was the closest thing to CJ that will ever, like, just a dynamo, fabulous, the ability to respond and quip and, you know, not throttle particular reporters, just exceptional. I think that's definitely a standout. I'm also going to say, this dates me, Murphy Brown from a journalistic point of view. You know, she was there around during my journalism school days. So I wanted to be just like her. In fact, I dressed as her for Halloween one year. I love that she was tough and spoke her mind, right? She didn't put up with any crap.
That was a great show. I was talking to someone just like last week because of all this, if you look at what's been happening since 2016 with Donald Trump and like just new crisis every weekend and still these documents and the raid, you couldn't do a show like The West Wing anymore or House of Cards. They had these elaborate, ridiculous plots and they're nowhere even as remotely as ridiculous as what's happening in real life.
I joke with my husband all the time. If somebody had presented the Trump script, presidency script, to a producer, they would have laughed and said, this is too unbelievable. No one will buy it. You're right. It's like it makes House of Cards look like
Friends.
You know. Yeah, right?
It looks pedestrian.
It's just absolutely... And just, you know, just when you think you've hit bottom, it's like, nope, that escalator goes further down.
So riffing on the Murphy Brown thing, I really, every time I get someone on here from either communications or journalism, I like to find out their take on the state of journalism in Canada. And I compare this to, like, you know, when I came out of school and I came out and I started working as a journalist, it was like the early mid 90s. Things are so different today. When you look around at what's going on, and not just the Lisa LaFlamme, but just across the board, local, like, you know, the local papers disappearing, subscriptions going down, the thickness of the paper, advertising revenue, all the reporters who are gone. When you look at that, what do you think the net impact is for Canadians, for the industry, for journalists, just
for democracy, right? I mean, I think we've seen that is you get, like, first of all, they're all covering the same news. Like, I can change the channel four times on four different networks and they all pretty much have the same story and it's still ambulance chasing or right. So A, you don't get the in-depth stuff anymore. And it's kind of all the same. And so people, and because of digital platforms, people have also migrated online and then they can just that, you know, singular focus. And so we've seen the impact of the smaller papers happening is you've got people getting their information elsewhere on these, you know, very specific, crazy Facebook groups. And people are no longer have that critical thinking over what's true anymore and disinformation. And, you know, if somebody says it often enough, that's not true, they'll believe it. And, you know, you've got, you know, Fox, it's not even news. It's like, it's not even infotainment, for heaven's sakes. And so I think it's really, really sad. And then so when Bell, what I saw a story somewhere where the Bell decision is because, you know, broadcasting they see is sort of the part of the business is not going to make them any money. So they'd rather put it on digital. But I you know, there's still a important part of the population that needs that. There's obviously crossover between the broadcast. I have to say, one of the things that drives me crazy now as consequence of COVID is journalists now using the Zoom interview as part of their story package. You know, back in the day, a camera used to have to go to somebody's office or to somebody's home or somebody had to come into the studio. And now they're sitting wherever doing the interview and then it's broadcast on TV. And the least that they could do is a producer could say, hey, could you adjust your lighting or could you move the camera up, put it under some books or something. But oh, it's just so, and that's, you know, and I think they've seen great, like we can get rid of producers now, we can get rid of cameramen and we can just do Zoom interviews. But I really don't like that. So I think it's in danger. And I think the journalism schools, you know, obviously have to adjust. I think more and more journalism grads are probably going into the corporate journalism, right? And content development. And so that's part of it. So, and I don't have the answer for it, but I've seen, you know, it's a real decline. Otherwise we wouldn't be complaining in creating entire reports on disinformation and trust indexes and all of that.
I remember when I first got a work email and internet access, I forget the exact year, but I think it was like 96, 97, somewhere around there. And I remember the Globe and Mail had a website and they had news for free. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. And I remember thinking like, this is cool today, but like, what does this look like in 20 years? And now obviously we're seeing, and I have a sister who works there, right? She's been there for about 14 years as a health reporter, but, and you know, I go home, I'm originally from Sault Ste. Marie. I'll go home and I'll see the paper, the Sault Star. That was the thing that I learned how to read with that. And it used to be three sections and it had some weight when it hit the table.
Yeah.
And now it's like a little flyer and just the,
And was it daily or was it?
It was daily. Yeah. 6 days a week.
Is it still daily?
I don't know. It might be, but right. Like, it's 20% of the weight that it used to have.
Yeah.
And the, is there a way back or is there like some reinvention of this? Do you think we get to a certain, like a bottom and maybe local news has a resurgence at some point, or are we just kind of screwed?
Well, I don't know if we're screwed. That seems quite
that's
fatalistic.
A little dark. Yeah.
But I don't know if there's a way back to resurrect local journalism, local stories. I think there has to be a conscious effort to get it somehow, and for people to either want to buy it or want to read it, because there's so much choice out there that, and then, you know, we see the other extreme is that people just aren't tuning in at all, right? They're not tuning in to television because they've cut off their cable.
Yeah, that's big.
They're not tuning in, you know, they're not on social media. They don't listen to the radio. I don't know how they get their news. And they're not informed. And these are people that are supposed to vote in elections or go get a vaccine, or like it's added that added layer of complication would be a polite way of saying it, to convey information that's critical to continue democracy, right? And not to mention the diversity of population that we're dealing with, right? And the languages. That was one of the mistakes that was made around COVID, is that they weren't doing it, producing it in enough languages, and we ended up with, what was it, vaccine hunters, who basically were doing the job that the government should have been doing. And, you know, there was a story, one of my students living in Brampton said there was actually a Punjabi group that got together of journalists and PRs and a whole bunch of other people to make sure the information was getting out to the Brampton community in the language that they were used to receiving. So all of those layers, right? People, we're not communicating to a monolith vanilla audience anymore. And so understanding that, where people get their information and when and how, and this speaks for the general public externally, but internally we need to understand that as well. And many organizations internally are still trying to figure this out, even after COVID, when internal communications became paramount. They're still figuring out how to reach out to employees who are working remotely. Mm.
Do you think that there is a glass ceiling, so to speak, in PR in Canada? And I guess not even Canada, just in PR in general.
For women?
Yeah. Because it's mostly women in the industry, right? But
yes, except, so statistically, I think, and I did a paper on this, so about 85% of the industry is female, except when you look at the leadership, it's flipped. So only 15% of leadership is female in the industry. So something is happening there in the middle ground that seems to be preventing women from getting into the senior levels. And so there's a number of reasons. And again, this goes back to academic research, that sometimes there's a perception of glass ceiling. Sometimes it's cultural. Sometimes, you know, family duty calls. I have to say, there's, with the Lisa Laflamme, there's been ageism and misogyny, but, you know, you can also layer into that sort of, I don't know if it's called motherism, but things start happening when you have kids that definitely impact your career, whether by choice or by, you know, not choice. So is there, I don't think there has to be a glass ceiling, but there has to be a recognition of realities that are at play. Their queen bee syndrome is still out there. Queen bee is when a woman perhaps is in power, but is doing no favors to the women beneath them to help them advance their careers because they didn't have anybody helping them. So why should I help you? And actually makes life a living hell. There doesn't have to be a glass ceiling. I think there is a more willingness of organizations, you know, if they are making a commitment to diversify, which many did, okay, oh, we have to diversify our executive, we have to diversify our work, right? That's an easy area for them to reach into and say, well, we've got a female in our leadership position in comms, right? Same with HR there, right? Hopefully that's not one and done, but is there a glass ceiling? Yes. Does there have to be? No. But I think there, a lot of things have to happen in order to build that staircase for women. And I think a lot of that has been aided by COVID, because many companies, you know, I remember going into an organization or into a meeting with the heads of PR companies, and they were talking about, you know, agencies often face a middle level gap in skill and talent. They sort of have their entry level, they've got their coordinators, and they've got their senior leaders, and then they sort of drop out, you know, in the account manager, account director level. And they were talking about working from home, and I did some research in this in sort of my organizational effectiveness class in my master's. And, you know, the leaders weren't willing to work from home. Well, I can't work from home. It's not going to work. And so my staff can't work from home, don't want to work from home. I'm like, well, they don't want to work from home because they see you not working from home, and they feel if they're working from home, then they're going to miss out on promotions. So I think COVID has sort of flattened that out and made people realize that you don't have to be sitting in a cubicle, you know, from 9 to 5 to be productive. You can be productive wherever you feel you can be productive. And the ground is shifting on that, thankfully. And I think that will benefit women. Ought to benefit men as well. I mean, it's also not just a female issue, right? Like men are part of the game too. And men need to be supportive, and men need to say, like, I got to go pick up my kid from school because they have a runny nose, and not make their wife do it. Then the balance is changing. A great author, which I highly recommend, is Anne-Marie Slaughter. She used to work for Hillary Clinton, and I think she now runs the Family Institute in the US. And she wrote an amazing book, which really talked about sort of work-life balance, but not to see it as sort of a care issue. It's really, it is more of a care issue, right? Because we're also in that sandwich generation where many people are not just having to look after kids, but perhaps are now looking after their elders as well. And so the balance is shifting, but part of the good news is that men want an active role in all of this as well, because they need to be part of the solution. Absolutely.
You referenced the big PR firms in one of your answers. And so I think of like the Nationals, the Cohen Wolves, the Edelmans, that kind of thing. Do you think that those firms, given what's happened in the last, like, let's say 20, 25 years, do you think those firms are less relevant today when it comes to, you're shaking your head?
No. Finish your question.
Well, I think like, and maybe I'm looking at this just through my biased lens, but I remember I started my own company in 2003, and a lot of people said, you're crazy. Like, cause I was basically a guy with a BlackBerry and a laptop and a dream, to sound kind of corny. And they said, you're never going to be able to compete with these organizations. And I guess on paper they were right, because I had to change my business model. I wanted to be doing media training and no one would hire me for that. But I look around today and there's so many solopreneurs, there's so many small providers, and maybe it's just this kind of this dream that I have, David and Goliath, but I personally feel like those large firms are less relevant, or maybe it's easier for a sole practitioner or a small team to win business today, or am I kind of misreading that? Just because
I don't like, and I also want to be kind to all PR firms because they hire my students.
That's right.
So I do think, you know, pretty much anybody can hang a shingle these days, which is good, but it's also bad because, again, going back to credibility, not every person who decides to hang a shingle, right, ought to be, you know, they're not in a position to give advice, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there is a place for the big, medium, and small. I think there will always be a place to educate organizations on the value of public relations over advertising, for example. And then there's so many niche aspects to it. You know, when I do independent stuff, I love doing comm strategies. You know, I'm happy to write somebody a comm strategy, really understand their business, have that conversation, develop a strategy for them, and then coach them on the people that they need to execute it. Because I don't want to be writing tweets. It's not really my thing. So, but I love doing that meaty strategic piece and advising them on that. So I think, you know, there's room for many players. Some players ought to be weeded out. And I would just say for both sides, again, to do your homework, you know, organizations wanting PR need to do their homework of what they're actually looking for and what's the best fit, and then vice versa.
But don't you think the market, sorry, I didn't mean to jump in. Don't you think the market weeds out the people who shouldn't be?
I would hope so. Yeah.
Because,
yeah, but like, they're still there. Like, I just, they're still there. Eventually it will, you know.
On a like, long enough timeline. I can see you're picturing faces in bubbles above your head, but I won't ask you for any names.
Yeah, no, eventually it will, right? Yeah. Because the same with, don't even get me going on influencers, right?
No, give you me know, some stuff. Influencers.
That's what I did my master's research on. And, yeah. You know, the influencer industry, I think, really soiled the PR industry, to be honest. And now it's really, you know, a lot of PR strategy and tactics, especially the lifestyle stuff, is negotiating contracts with influencers who are demanding money for a few posts based on audience. And is that audience all yours? But, you know, just like the people who hang their shingle, the audience will eventually, you know, if you're not an authentic influencer and providing value and, you know, evidence that you're actually using the product and you actually believe in what you're talking about, the audience will determine their business model by unfollowing, and they will lose that cachet that they have that allows them to go to PR firms and demand money. And every time they get new, you know, every campaign is, you know, more money. It used to be like, I don't know, $2,000 for, and now it's just insane.
It's crazy.
And it's, yeah. Lifestyle PR never really was my thing. I did a little bit in it. That's one of the reasons why I chose to research influencers, because it was changing the landscape of PR. And I really, was having trouble sitting with the idea of paid PR, because is it advertising, but they pretend to be journalists. They don't have code of ethics. There is no association that they're represented by. They can really charge whatever they want to charge. So, and I think that authentic content that everybody's trying to achieve has been sacrificed in many cases.
I remember I did my thesis in journalism school on the tabloidization, if that's a word, of mainstream news. And this is, again, in like 93, 94. And my thesis advisor, and, you know, he's kind of young and naive. And yeah, I guess I'm still sort of naive, not young anymore. But he was kind of bristling, and he didn't really, and I realized he's a producer for CBC. That's who he was. And so I was kind of like whizzing in his cornflakes a little bit. But how I did this, it wasn't super scientific, but I had a bunch of VHS tapes and I taped a series of shows. I even forget what they were, but it was like the Global Evening News, CTV Evening News, CBC Evening News, and then like Hard Copy, Inside Edition, all, you know, what all those different shows, went through, time stamped all the different stories, and they were covering the same stories. It was like the Michael Jackson allegations, and it was, I found that really interesting. And this is like 25, 26, 27 years ago. So, you talk about influencers, the story that just popped up into my mind when you said about being genuine is, I don't know if you remember when BlackBerry was still producing phones and they had their last flagship phone that they were producing. I think it was like the Key One or something like that. And they hired Alicia Keys. Do you remember this? And she came out and she was like their sponsor for the thing. And she was tweeting about the phone on the day. And at the bottom of the tweet, it said send by iPhone, because, you know, that's like automatically on there. And so everybody was super pissed and she had to delete it. That's the kind of stuff that you end up with, right?
Well, you can. I mean, that's why contracts have to be super explicit. So, you know, we train PR students how to negotiate contracts now, right? Like if you, you know, I focused on, you know, the mommy influencers, but if you want the kid to be in the post, well, in my mind, that's a separate contract for the child. Like their payment must go to the child. However you're doing it, because they're not really giving you permission. the child, right? So, and you have to prove you use the product. It has to be, you know, I went after one because they were talking about sort of going in and I'm only going to buy higher end products now because even if it costs more money, because it's better for the environment or whatever. And I sent her a note and said, wow, that's pretty rich. Consider you represent X company. She went after me. Her DM back to me was quite nasty. And I just decided I just unfollowed her because she's been known to post her DMs. And I'm like, I don't need to go down there, but honey, I'm right. I'm so right on this one. And I've got the research to back up. And I just thought her response, considering, you know, part of your job as an influencer is engagement, was a little nastier than it ought to have been. Clearly had hit a nerve.
Would you like to tell us who it was?
No, I'm not going to tell. Well, maybe. No, I don't.
Was she from the States?
No, Canadian. Yeah.
Okay, we'll let that one, we'll marinate. Maybe we'll get that one out before the end. And that's the other thing is like people posting their DMs. Like you never know. You think a private conversation, now it's on Twitter. You know,
right?
It used to be like, you know, hey, can we have some rules and respect here? Jeez.
Yeah. So it's dangerous. It's, I just find, so I have a big sort of asterisk caution mark, you know, with the whole influencers. But honestly, if you want to get into lifestyle PR, your primary strategy is influencers. And also, you know, we mentioned talking about, you know, 22-year-olds now coming into PR. That's what they're used to. That's the content that they're used to. So many of them are like, yeah, I want to work with influencers. I'm like, oh. Right? Media relations is like, what's that? I'm like, well, you have to read the newspaper to understand what media relations is. So that's often a challenge, is to get them to read the news because they don't have access to newspapers. They don't have cable TV. I'm like, just download the CBC app, if nothing else, and play CBC radio as you're getting dressed for school in the morning. That's all I ask.
They're getting their news from TikTok. So,
right? Yeah.
I've given some lectures at colleges. I'd say maybe a dozen over the years. And Centennial was certainly one. And is it true that that building was the building they filmed Degrassi in? Is that true?
Yes. And they still do tours.
That's a fun fact.
So there was one a few years ago before COVID, there was a tour and they, you know, haul up a big bus. It was in June. And I'm just coming out of my office and I could hear them saying, this is where so-and-so's head was slammed in during the... I'm like... It's my office.
Oh my God.
Anyways, they were, I popped out and the fans like, oh, what is this? They're like, oh, it's the Degrassi tour. I'm like, can I join you? They're like, come on. They were so friendly. And I ended up getting pictures with Joey Jaramouche. And like, it was just absolutely bonkers. That's because funny. They have an insane fan base.
Cult base. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, this is just the campus. And they're so like, taking pictures of walls and
has a meaning for them. So you can choose to answer this or not, but I, because you're in this business and you're an educator, you're here year in and year out. I kind of visit and I leave for the day. So I've never been, it was the first time I'd ever been at the front of a class. I've always been the student looking at the teacher. And one thing that really struck me is like, let's say there's 30 kids in a class. There's like, I don't know, four of them that are like locked in. You can see in their eyes, and the rest of them, like, and who knows what's going on. They were out partying or whatever. But do you know, I saw you nodding your head. So you know what I'm talking about. You can just see the ones that are locked in. Is there any correlation over time with those people and the success in their careers? Like, is that too obvious or am I kind of missing something?
No. Yeah. You get out of it what you put into it. I tell them that from day one. I tell them that in the applicant session. The students who are engaged, who are asking questions, who are questioning some, you know, often what we're saying and, you know, challenging us, who put the extra effort into assignments, who sign up for, you know, who take a leadership role in groups, 100% they do better. 100%. You know, where they land in the future, I, you know, haven't quite tried, but, you know, I've got some doing extremely well, several, you know, promoted within a couple of years, you know, starting at entry level and, winning awards. I had one that was out speaking, at the big conference that was in, Nice, France this, summer. And she was, you know, as a speaker for that, talking about diversity. So, yeah, absolutely.
That's so interesting. 100%. And then I found myself wondering, I wonder what I look like to my teachers. Because it just, you're looking at one person as a student, but you see all these kids and you could see, bing, bing, bing. Those are the ones that are like locked in.
But then there's also the other layer who are locked in, but they don't necessarily have the confidence to raise their hand or... Right. They're still sort of in that middle ground of I'm smart, but I don't know it yet.
Maybe introverted, a little shy or
whatever. They're introverted, they're shy or they're, you know, and I was a little bit like that, right? Like you kind of hold back and then somebody answers a question and you're like, that's what I was thinking. So perhaps I should have said it. So that's, you know, you've got those ones as well who haven't quite fully blossomed yet. And you know, and those are the ones that I'm saying like, you've got it all going on. I love having these conversations, you know, and you're the only thing standing in your way. You just need to get out of your own head.
I have a couple quick more questions. Obviously I want to respect your time. The first one is I did an interview with a reporter called Katrina Clark. I don't know if you know the name, but she was with the Hamilton Spectator, investigative reporter. She just moved to Winnipeg. She's working there now. Really great reporter. I think her biggest time spent is just filing FOI requests at work, and she's dealing with school boards and hospitals, and she's really a great journalist. And we had this really interesting conversation about what she wishes corporate communications leaders knew about journalism, because obviously there's good ones, there's bad ones. You have the people who, when journalists call with some sort of, you know, tricky, controversial issue, they put up the walls, they don't respond, they ghost the reporter, here's a statement, you're obviously trying to be spun and handled. And then you have the ones that are transparent and timely and frank, and obviously that's a very black and white characterization, but if you could give some advice as a career communicator, someone who's been in agency and associations and education to the leaders of these corporate communications departments, what would you want them to know that they... For the ones who are kind of like in that gap where they could be a little bit better, what would be your advice to them?
You need to understand the business. You need to really understand and what's going on outside of it that it could impact the business. Like if you don't have that strategic sensibility, you're going to stymie your own career. It's going to be very, very hard to advance it. And again, you know, to that comment about the media, you know, when I was at Manulife, it was very important to develop. I think I fall in that second category, but developing relationships with the journalists, where if I couldn't help them, I would, you know, be flat out and say, I can't help you, but why don't you try this, this, and this? And it was a constant back and forth and one of mutual respect. You know, there was one that was going to publish a story. It was, and he had the wrong story. He called me to tell me what the story that he was running with. And I said, I couldn't say anything because everything was super confidential. Everything was in negotiations. And I just said, I wouldn't run that if I were you. And he's like, well, why? And I'm like, I just went, it was a Friday afternoon. I'm like, I just, that's all I can say. I just, if I were you, I wouldn't quite run it as you have it. And he kept bugging me and I'm like, okay, gotta go by. And I actually hung up on it because that's all I could say. Yeah. And then the following Tuesday he called and he had the story correct. But I couldn't say anything. But this time I said, I cannot comment on rumor or speculation. Right. It's like, okay, thanks. Like, gotta go, bye. So I think there's, you know, there's a level of respect there. They had a respect for, I think governance is really important in the communications department. if you don't have protocols and policies and when this happens, here's the line of things that needs to whether that's a quarterly release, it's the same every quarter. It doesn't change. Right. And, you know, what is your media relations governance and policy of who can speak and when to speak and who has to approve and what lawyers and how much advance and if something's in a hurry, like all of that has to be locked in. And I love doing that stuff. Mm-hmm. But shockingly, a lot of departments exist without governance. And all that is putting structure. It's like math. It's like putting a formula into what you do. And so there's a predictability. So you're not running around, oh, no, what do we do, right? Who do we talk to, right? And so we had that with media relations. And so there was a predictability, like if you call me, this you I will answer and I will get you a spokesperson or I will tell, you know, give you information or I will tell you if I can't and I will not waste your time. And that was understood and respected. And so, you know, that was a long-worded win for advice, but understand the business, build those relationships and have the governance and policies in place. And that involves research and creating that system and structure.
That's a great answer. I would often tell people too, like you can't make, if you don't have a structure in place, it's really difficult to make decisions when there's a crisis situation, because you're doing it with a mind that's in a crisis state. When you have those policies in place, you've kind of made your decision in advance. If X happens, we will do this. And you've kind of made the decision to do the right thing before the thing happens.
Yeah. I mean, if nothing else, you know who needs to approve the statement, right? Or doesn't need to approve the statement. Like something that's fluffy, okay, we're going to involve more people that needs to be involved in this just to make them feel, because a lot of the stuff that you do is just to make people feel good. And that's relationship building. But when something is more confidential, then your you know, approvals group becomes tighter and more constrained, obviously. But even just knowing that, right, and being able to make those split second decisions to say, okay, so-and-so, these three people need to see it. It's not leaving without, you know, lawyers are your best friends. Also great advice for corporate communications department. And I also tell my students, always find somebody in finance that is willing to answer your questions as if you're six. Because, you know, a lot of people go into PR because they hate math. Well, too bad you have to do math. But, you know, there are situations where you're explaining the financials, you know, so there are limits to you understanding the business, obviously. So you need to know when you need to go deeper, who's your subject matter expert. So I had a guy in Manulife that I would call and like, talk to me like I'm six, because I'm the one that has to talk to the journalist and they're going to be answering questions that require a very simple answer. And so knowing the right questions to ask, and that's the journalism background that helps with that.
There's a wisdom in that though, right? Because a lot of people would be, you're kind of pretending to be this level and like, I don't want to ask the, like, you know what I mean? Like for you to put yourself in that position, there's a certain amount of confidence and self-awareness there. Like not to just throw out compliments.
Don't fake it. Like don't fake financials, man. No, like if you're going out a spokesperson, and I was at Manulife, so my name is attached to a quote, you should have the fear of just be terrified when you're talking to a journalist, because if the CEO is reading the paper the next day, he better be happy with that quote. Exactly. So yeah, you check all your T's and I's and double check with the source. And I'm saying this, are you cool with it? Yes. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. I remember what got me credibility at Manulife is when I was doing a news release. This was like one of the very first pieces on US tax law. It was a very confusing news release. And the CEO and the head who was leading this initiative said, they looked at me and they're like, you don't need to worry about this. And it was really, I felt quite condescending the way they said it. I was super young. I was like 30 and not really used to dealing with females. And I'm like, actually, I do need to understand it because I'm the one that has to explain it to the journalist. And they both were like, whoa, what?
Good for you.
What? And you know what? They did. I'm like, okay, it's clear. We just wrote a sentence that was clear. So maybe they won't have to call me because we just wrote a very clear sentence.
Good for you for saying that. Are you a podcast person? Do you listen to them or not really? Or are you more of a reader?
I should. It's on my list of things I ought to be doing. Yeah, okay. I think podcasts are great. In fact, my very first assignment that I have my students do is a podcast.
Nice.
But it's not done sort of this style. It's done more like a scripted radio interview where they have to write this, they have to summarize the interview and then script it, and then they can insert clips. And what they have to do is they have to go out and find a communicator and interview them about their profession. And then they package this piece, but it's kind of a writing exercise because when you're reading the script, you realize all of the goofiness in your writing, right? You're like, oh, I just said that word, or I can't breathe after this sentence. It must be too long. So that is their very first assignment that they do. So are for any communicators listening, if you get a call from a Centennial PR student, please do the interview with them.
Nice. Any books that you, I'm always looking for recommendations, whether it's podcast, audiobook, books, that were, and it doesn't have to be about communications, but anything that was formative to you or something that you go back to or that you've lent to people that you would like to share with others that, that they would get something out of?
I'm going to go back to that Anne Marie Slaughter book, and I wish I knew the name of it, and it's just not at the tip of my tongue right now, but I think that every organization should be reading that right now because it's really about how the workplace needs to transform.
All right. Thanks. We'll look that up. And I'll give you the classic journalism question before we go. Anything else that you'd like to add before we wrap up?
No, I think this was good. You covered a lot of territory. I was thinking whether I want to name that influencer, but I'm not, but I'll just give you a hint. She was the one that ruined somebody's life basically and career in a heartbeat.
This is a couple of years ago, right?
Yeah.
I remember. Yeah. Okay. I know who it was.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was just quite ugly, uglier than it ever needed to be.
Okay. So anyone who can connect the dots on that one, we'll just leave it out in the ether. How's that?
Yeah. We'll just leave it there. Yeah.
All right.
It'll be like an Easter egg, like a Taylor Swift Easter egg.
Donna, thank you so much. This has been great to chat with you. I hope we can do this again sometime, maybe in person and maybe with beverages in front of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Look forward to it.
Thanks once again to Donna for taking the time to speak with me. And as always, thanks to you for taking the time to listen. If you haven't had a chance to do so, please rate, review, or recommend the show. Helps other people to find this content. Thank you once again for listening, and we'll see you next time.